you're not a current member, become one. You've got just a couple minutes here before the show really starts. You can go there right now, kboo.fm. Click on Donate Today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And by The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Some food in my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away, just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way.
Welcome to the KBOO Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. Today on the show, we'll hear an interview with Congressman Blumenauer regarding the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign, a campaign attempting to involve Oregonians' voices in the next farm bill. We'll also be talking with performer and author Liz Carlisle about her new book, The Lentil Underground, and Agriculture in Eastern Montana. At the end of the program, we'll be talking with Matt Reed of Be Thinking about his recent experience on the television show Shark Tank. But first, we have Marisha Auerbach here in the studio to talk with us about what's happening in the garden this month and to share some permaculture tips. Marisha is a permaculture teacher and consultant here in Portland, teaching a variety of classes with multiple organizations, including monthly classes at People's Co-op. Her next class is this Saturday, April 18th, and the topic is A Permaculture Approach to Tending and Building Soil. Marisha, welcome to the Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
So let's start from the very basics. What does the term permaculture mean?
Well, permaculture is actually a design system that's based in the intrinsic qualities of each place. And so depending on where I'm working, depends on how we apply permaculture design. So we're designing our lives based on where we live, based on the climate and different considerations, cultural considerations. And in that, we design positive lifestyles. So we decrease our impact on the environment, increase our connection with the world around us. And permaculture design includes where our food comes from, how we build our homes, how we heat our homes, how we interact in our communities, our economic systems that we participate in, and it affects all different scales of life. And sometimes I teach in the tropics, and sometimes I teach here in Portland. So it's different whether I'm working with the Mayan farmers in Belize that I work with every February, or folks at Portland Community College, where I'll be teaching a course this summer.
So every single class you teach is pretty much specific to the place where you're teaching the class.
Yeah, permaculture is based in a set of ethics and principles that are based on observation of nature that kind of guide us on how we can create, you know, how we can design our lives so that they fit harmoniously with the natural systems of the earth. And I find that, you know, right now we have so many choices in life. You know, we can purchase things that come from all over the world, and there's lots of hidden costs and all these different things that we participate in. And the permaculture design system has helped me kind of slim down the choices so that I can really see the impacts that I have and participate in the community in a good way.
So could you give us an example of permaculture in practice?
Well, we have really great examples of permaculture in practice here in Portland. And the one that I'd really like to highlight is the Village Building Convergence, which is 10 days of natural building and permaculture projects that happen in the end of May every year. This year, it's the 15th annual Village Building Convergence. I think there's probably not a single person in Portland that hasn't driven by one of those painted intersections or found a free library on the street corner. And these beautiful artistic installations cause us to stop and connect with community, and they also reflect on our unique culture of this city. Installations that go in by neighbors collectively joining together in their community to put up that cultural expression of what they'd like so that they can connect more deeply with the people around them.
And then what in that, you know, when I think of permaculture, I do think of kind of gardening, and I know you've said it's more general, it's more broad than that. It's more sort of like all life-based. But what specifically in some of those Village Building Convergence projects would you describe as like the process of permaculture?
Well, I think of permaculture as asking us to slow down so that we can deeply connect with our community and with the environment in which we live. And the Village Building Convergence is a great example of social permaculture, where neighborhoods are coming together to connect more deeply with each other and their sense of place. And sometimes we plant gardens. It's a little bit late in the end of May to be planting gardens. There was an event called City Riparian that happened in the fall, where there's more garden installations that go on. I know with the Southeast Permaculture Convergence in March, there's a lot more gardens that go in neighborhoods. But with the Village Building Convergence, it's more about natural building, a lot of cob construction for anyone who wants to learn about cob, which is a building method using clay, straw, and sand. There's a lot of benches that go in. People have done things like insulated their house using natural materials. And so there's a lot of skill sharing that happens with the Village Building Convergence to help neighbors learn how to do these things so we can be more self-reliant in our community and have less of an impact globally on the earth by using materials that we don't really know where they came from or who was impacted by our choices.
So let's make that transition into the garden. What are some things that people can be doing right now, permaculture-wise, that they can implement in their gardens?
Right now is a really great time to be building the compost pile and be thinking about how to build soil fertility in your landscape as we come into the growing season. It's time to plant greens, and peas are in the ground right now, potatoes. And the more that we can develop our soil to have a lot of organic matter in it, the less water we're going to need in the garden in the summer. Soils that have about 2% organic matter in them reduce the need for water by about 75% than soils that don't have as much organic matter in them. And by composting, you know, we can take things from the waste stream and turn it into black gold, into rich nutrients for our garden. There's a lot of impacts from getting compost from places where you don't know where it came from. We got a bunch of alpaca manure one year from some people who didn't treat their alpacas with chemicals, and it sounded like they did all the right things, you know, other than feeding them organic feed. And we actually got a contaminant in the alpaca manure through their feed. It was non-organic feed, and it had clopyralid in it, which is also known as aminopyralid. There's a number of different trade names, and it's a broadleaf herbicide that's used on grain crops. And this chemical actually went through the bellies of the alpaca and killed my tomatoes in 3 days. There were strong plants. They were in 3-gallon containers, and they were done in about 3 days from using this manure lightly on the soil. So building soil and composting locally can really reduce the impacts of having things that you might not know the consequences of in your garden from getting compost from somewhere else.
So let's say somebody has a small backyard garden and they're starting their first compost pile. What's some advice that you would give to them?
Well, with a small space, I'd actually advise people to start a worm bin. And a worm bin is, there's various types of containers that you can have that you have worms in them, and you feed your worms your food scraps. And then you layer that in with shredded newspaper or leaves as the bedding for the worms. Worms don't like anything too pungent, so I don't feed my worms citrus or hot pepper. peppers, onions, or garlic. And the worms actually convert the food scraps into worm castings pretty rapidly. So that works a lot faster for people in a really small space or someone who's in an apartment. If they want to just stop throwing their food into the garbage, which would end up with methane, you know, releasing methane or sending it off even in the municipal compost, which is a fine thing to do, but you can use it at home. And if you have an apartment, worm castings can just be used to top dress your plants inside too and provide soil fertility.
So let's talk a little bit about this year. It's been kind of a crazy winter. It's been warm and dry, more so than in the past. What kind of effects will that have on the garden this season?
Well, right now it seems like we're almost a month ahead of where we were last year as far as plant growth, things that are have appeared this season. Our last frost on average is April 26th. And so I'd still advise people to not jump the gun and start planting out warm season crops, even though it's going to feel really warm on Saturday. I think it's going to get up to 70 degrees on Saturday, which will be really nice. The thing I'm really concerned about because of the warm and dry winter is the aphid problem. We had really bad aphids last year with our warm season, relatively warm summer, and this winter hasn't gotten cold enough to kill off some of these pests. So that's going to be something to look out for. In my garden, we tend to work with the pests by having chickens. So that's a way of connecting different elements in the permaculture garden so that one element is having their needs met by something else. So the chickens eat the insects and they need about a third bugs in their diet. Otherwise, you know, discouraging insects with having really good soil fertility, lots of compost in your soil discourages pests because your plants are strong. They get the fertility they need. Or having aromatic plants can also discourage pests.
And, you know, kind of want to go to the big picture. We're talking about permaculture, but I'm wondering why permaculture? Why should we practice permaculture?
Well, I think there's a number of different concerns right now environmentally and socially, and by focusing on the local picture, we can really make it so that we don't have hidden costs and things. We can see where our food comes from so that we're not, you know, getting almonds from California is the, you know, big example right now. Whenever you get food that comes from California, what you're really getting is California's water supply. And, you know, when you're getting food here from Portland, whether it's growing it yourself or buying it from a local farmer's market, what you're doing is supporting our local economy, being able to steward our local environment, and then you don't have that hidden nature of things that come from other places, whether it's flowers from Colombia. If you pick up a bouquet of flowers to bring home, then, you know, you're picking up some of Colombia's water there and their nutrients. That's all in the products that we bring from somewhere else. And there's watersheds that are drying up all over the world. And it's mostly because of these hidden costs of the things that we choose to consume.
So the permaculture has been in the conversation for years now because of this sort of move to organic sustainability. What do you think it's going to mean for permaculture with all this talk of water and this drought that we're going through this year?
Well, I hope that it brings some more awareness to closed system design, to really analyzing where we are and looking at the full picture of the different influences in each given space so that we can design from a holistic approach where, you know, if we're stewarding our watersheds and we're planting more trees, that's increasing the oxygen that's in our atmosphere, that's increasing the habitat for birds and for other critters. And I think that a holistic approach has lots of far-reaching consequences on living, on stewarding this earth in a better way.
So we've got a question in, and I think, you know, we talked a little bit about how to cut off, you know, beforehand, how to improve your garden so that the aphid problem isn't bad. Let's say you have aphids. Is there a tip to deal with them when you have them?
I've actually known someone who had aphids on their roses who just top dressed with good compost and the aphids went away. So soil fertility really helps. I tend to have some plants that have aphids just because everything has its place in the system. And once the aphid situation gets pretty overwhelming on that plant, I'll throw it to my chickens. But not everyone has chickens. I think soil fertility, just having, you know, lots of compost in your soil. Another really important tip for aphids is we find that in the summer, it really affects our brassicaceae plants. That's our kales and kale and broccoli and cabbage. And so growing plants in the appropriate season. Kales and broccoli, those are all cool season crops. And so you don't want to have them with the hot western sun hitting them in the summer. That just gets them way too hot, and that's how they respond, as they get aphids. So if I'm going to be growing something like Brussels sprouts, which you want to plant right now and hopefully give it everything it needs until November, Brussels sprouts is really challenging because it gets so hot in the summer. So how I'll design that space in my garden is I'll put something in front of the Brussels sprouts so it gets the shade from the western sun, even the shade from the southern sun, during the heat of the summer, and then it doesn't seem as susceptible to aphids and other pests.
Great. So we have about a minute left, and I want to hear from you about the workshops that you're going to be giving in the near future.
Okay, well, this Saturday, I'm doing a hands-on soil building methods workshop in the Cully neighborhood. We'll be talking about how to build a compost pile. We'll be actively building a compost pile. We'll be building a worm bin. We're going to be doing sheet mulching. We're going to be putting in hugel culture beds, which is a type of mound bed using woody debris, which is slow-release nutrients for the soil. We're going to be doing the whole gamut of permaculture techniques for building soil. So if people want to learn how to do that, that's an all-day workshop in Cully on April 18th. Then I teach this once-a-month workshop series on what to do now in the garden, and it started in February, and it goes through November. It's at People's Food Co-op, and the next one is on Tuesday, May 5th, and we're going to be focusing on warm season crops, edible flowers, and attracting pollinators in your garden.
Great. And where can people find that calendar?
What to do now in your garden is actually on the People's Food Co-op calendar, and my upcoming permaculture courses are found on permaculturerising.com, and I will be teaching a full permaculture design course this summer at Portland Community College.
Great. Marisha, thanks so much for being on the Food Show.
Thanks, Chris.
That's Marisha Auerbach from talking about permaculture and what you can do in your garden. You're listening to the Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. The Farm Bill was last authorized in 2014. This bill authorizes funding for billions of dollars of taxpayer money and sets policy for federal farm and food programs. These programs include support for commodity crops, farmland conservation programs, trade and marketing support, nutrition programs, crop insurance, and more. The next Farm Bill will be enacted in 2017, and in order to hear voices of Oregonians and work to reform the Farm Bill, Congressman Earl Blumenauer has launched the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign. According to the congressman, the Farm Bill falls short of enacting necessary reforms and maintains the pattern of cutting benefits for the vulnerable while spending taxpayer money on wasteful commodity subsidies. Oregon is getting shortchanged by the current priorities in the Farm Bill, and the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign is a way to engage Oregonians to bring together diverse voices to envision and consider policies and programs for the next Farm Bill. Food Show co-host Rachel Bennett spoke with Congressman Blumenauer, talking about the first phase of the campaign, which began in February and involves meeting with stakeholders across Oregon.
The Farm Bill was last authorized in 2014. This bill authorizes funding for billions of dollars of taxpayer money and sets policy for federal farm and food programs. These programs include support for commodity crops, farmland conservation programs, trade and marketing support, nutrition programs, crop insurance, and more. The next Farm Bill will be enacted in 2017. And in order to hear voices of Oregonians and work to reform the Farm Bill, Congressman Earl Blumenauer has launched the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign. According to the congressman, the Farm Bill falls short of enacting necessary reforms and maintains the pattern of cutting benefits for the vulnerable while spending taxpayer money on wasteful commodity subsidies. Oregon is getting shortchanged by the current priorities in the Farm Bill. And the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign is a way to engage Oregonians and to bring together diverse voices to envision and consider policies and programs for the next Farm Bill. I spoke with Congressman Blumenauer talking about the first phase of the campaign, which began in February and involved introducing the concept and meeting with stakeholders across Oregon. What has involvement in the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign looked like so far?
Well, I've talked to over 1,000 people in Oregon and in Washington, D.C. I'm finding people are intrigued. They kind of admit that there are lots of people who have tried to change the Farm Bill, but it's usually working around the edges. People deal with smaller pieces. It's not part of a comprehensive vision to really have a reformed approach that would do a better job for people who eat, pay taxes, and enjoy the opportunity to create farm products. So I am intrigued to this point that people seem to be interested. I've had this week in Portland. I've had three meetings already. I'm going to be at a synagogue in the evening. It's fun to talk about, to engage people, and we're looking forward to broader participation as the process continues.
What kind of proposals have you heard so far?
Well, it's interesting. There are people that are looking at reducing some of the unnecessary subsidies. I mean, for example, corn-based ethanol. We have a mismatch between some of our conservation programs that allow a few large agribusiness entities to siphon off lots of money, and there's not enough left over for the majority of smaller farmers and ranchers that would like some help protecting the environment. There's ideas about worker safety. We had with the migrant farm community a meeting in Woodburn this week, hearing about some of the problems, that the health problems that have occurred for migrant workers. And maybe part of what needs to happen is a health assessment of people who are actually doing much of the hard work in the fields to protect their health. So lots of disparate ideas, but the main point we're doing now is not so much trying to get people to jump to the conclusions, but for people to start thinking about the bigger picture, whether or not they want to be part of a process with their group or organization, and then come back later in the year as we bring people together to compare notes.
How do you expect that these ideas will be received in Congress?
Reforming farm policy has been a real struggle. I've been involved with these efforts since I first went to Congress, trying to trim back unnecessary subsidies and trying to support things that we need here in Oregon. Support for organic foods, support for our nursery and wine industry, strengthening conservation and animal protections. And it's been a mixed bag. We've made some progress. I mean, the public is slowly being motivated to speak out and argue for changes, but it's been slow to develop. And frankly, we are facing a very substantial array of big agribusiness interests that are entrenched and that benefit from the existing policies. And so it has been a struggle in the past. I think it's going to be a struggle in the future. But if we have a comprehensive vision that we can develop here in Oregon, it'll make it easier for us to make our case, and I think we'll be more successful.
Have you had the involvement of Oregonians in creating this vision in years past?
We have had a number of sessions inviting people from you know, the food bank, people involved with nutrition programs, agriculture, farmers markets, a wide array of folks that have been advising me every year that we have a farm bill under consideration. This year, what's different is we're trying to get a head start, starting much earlier in the process, and finding a way to engage more people in the big picture, rather than focusing on a few things like nutrition or environment individually. I'd like to see if we can work together on a comprehensive program for Oregon.
And what do you think some of the biggest barriers are?
The big problem we have is that not enough people pay attention to the Farm Bill. It's the most important environmental piece of legislation that most people have never heard of. We are facing well-organized entrenched interests who benefit mightily from the existing program. We have to mobilize more people to pay attention, get involved, work on refining an alternative vision, and that's the whole purpose of the project.
That was Congressman Earl Blumenauer talking about the first phase of the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign. The first phase of the campaign, involving stakeholder meetings, feedback, and policy sessions across Oregon, will continue through the month of April. The next step, beginning next month, is refining these ideas and crafting them into policy concepts to develop an Oregon Farm Bill draft for discussion and a playbook for listening sessions in other states. If you or an organization would like to be involved in any part of the campaign, you can contact the congressman by phone or email.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. That was co-host Rachel Bennett interviewing Congressman Earl Blumenauer talking about the Sing Your Own Farm Bill campaign. When we talk about organics, sustainable foods, eating locally, the conversation is mostly about produce and meats. This conversation excludes almost all of the middle part of the country where grains and other commodity crops are grown. In her recent book, Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America, Liz Carlisle examines this overlooked sector, chronicling the farmers who are attempting to diversify the conventional farm ecosystem. In the interview with Liz, we talk about those farmers as well as what their work means for the future of food. The interview was recorded here at KBOO Community Radio.
I'm Liz Carlisle, and I'm a fellow at the Center for Diversified Farming Systems at UC Berkeley, and I just wrote a book called Lentil Underground.
The kind of agriculture that happens in the central part of the country, where the book is set, mostly grains and commodity crops, is often overlooked. So how and why did you set out to tell this story?
I set out to tell this story about the Lentil Underground because I think the next stage of the food movement is changing family farm agriculture and large-scale agriculture, not just opting out of it, but actually converting those farms to diversified organic production. And I got to know this group of people in Montana who, over the course of the last 30 years, have been doing just that.
Could you give us a little bit of a background of sort of what you were discovering in Montana?
Yeah. So this movement that I chronicle got started really in the mid-80s, and it was a number of people mostly who were moving back to their family farms after having kind of raised their consciousness about what was going on worldwide with the fossil fuel crisis in the 70s with OPEC, with the environmental crisis. And it was hitting home because their families were going bankrupt because fertilizer prices got so high because of global fossil fuel markets. Grain prices were low, also a global commodity market issue. And the environmental problems were starting to show up as soil degradation, really, the natural resources they relied on for farming were being degraded, and it was starting to show up as an economic problem. So folks got together and decided, we really need to learn how to farm organically. But that was step one. They were at absolutely step one, and they were looking at people around the country who were doing that. But it's really different in Montana than it would be, say, in Portland or in California or in Brooklyn. You don't have the metropolitan consumer market right there. You don't have the same weather. It's cold. It's dry. You got to have something shelf-stable you can ship. So they invented, based on principles of organics and agroecology, what made sense in their region.
And I want to get into the book a bit, but first, you grew up in Montana, so I kind of want to have that sort of background. What was your experience, you know, growing up?
I grew up in Missoula, Montana. So I was on the western side of the Continental Divide. People in Missoula go outside to hike and bike and ski rather than farm and ranch. But I knew there was agriculture on the other side of the mountains. And my grandmother had been a farmer further in the Midwest. And I was curious about it. I was really curious. And I was particularly curious about what farmers learn as a result of working with the earth. Not just about farming, but about our place in the universe. So I always had this pull, and that's what led my first career was as a country singer, but to this path I followed throughout my life, really, seeking this agrarian philosophy.
So how did you get connected to the farmers in this book?
Well, after my career as a country singer, I got excited about policy issues because I was meeting farmers all over the country, and it was clear that the barriers for them were structural, economic and policy barriers. So I knew about this organic farmer from Montana who I'd heard about, who was a senator, Senator John Tester, and I went to work for him, thinking that he was just this oddball guy. He was the only organic farmer in eastern Montana. Well, I soon discovered he was part of this movement. And, you know, didn't really have enough time at the Senate to dig too deep into it. So went to grad school, started doing a research project with these folks, and then realized these are such characters. This has got to be a book.
There's this counterculture that you profile in the book. What do you know about the sort of the regular culture, farming and otherwise, in rural Montana?
Yeah. So folks started homesteading in Montana in the early part of the 20th century, and you have a lot of people who are third or fourth generation farmers, and it's been pretty much wheat and barley for that entire period of time. And so people have gotten fairly used to the rhythm that goes along with that. It started out a little more diversified at the beginning because people were homesteading, they were growing their own food. And then in the mid-century, of course, World War II chemicals were repurposed for agricultural use. And that's when community life started to run around the rhythm of chemically supported industrial agriculture. And so if you're in these communities, you know, there's the fertilizer dealer, there's the herbicide dealer, there's people who contract to spray. So this economic system is so closely woven into the fabric of community life that stepping outside that box and growing organic is perceived by many people as a great insult and an affront, you know, almost religious in a sense to the practice of that community.
Well, and one of the things that I found fascinating was this idea that if you no longer had to go to your dealer for chemicals, it was almost isolating because that was like a social interaction that you lost.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so the main character grew up in a town of a couple thousand people. So, you know, how many friends can you afford to lose? But the good news about that is that those strong bonds of community in those small towns, they can be repurposed. So when one or two people tried to go it alone and go organic, that was very lonely. But as they started to connect with one another through these farm improvement clubs and an NGO called the Alternative Energy Resources Organization, they had the knowledge of how to organize in community and work very closely together, precisely because of those social traditions that sort of in the hands of the other economic system were a barrier.
So tell us a little bit about those hubs. It was a lot of this movement happened because of people coming together, and they came together, you know, through some farming connections, but also the Alternative Energy Resource Organization. So give us a little bit of a background about these hubs of energy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it dates back really to the Farmers Union. That's what I found. So I did this as dissertation research and then wrote it as a general audience book. And in my research, both archival and interview, a lot of people learned organizing and cooperative development in the Farmers Union in the early part of the 20th century. And then a lot of those people's kids ended up getting involved in sort of counterculture type groups. And sort of the beginning of that was a group called the Northern Plains Resource Council. They were fighting coal development. There was a proposal in the late 60s, early 70s to dig up all of southeastern Montana and Wyoming, essentially. And this was a group of ranchers who said, we're going to lose our ability to ranch because this is going to destroy the quality of the natural resources we depend on. And if we just let these folks go one house to one house, they'll eventually beat us. But if we get together and decide we're not going to sell, we're not going to sell these mineral rights, maybe then we can continue to have agriculture here. So they did that, and they were relatively successful. But then they realized, so what's the energy future we want? If we're saying no to coal, what are we saying yes to? So that gave birth to the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. And they started to focus on wind and solar, and then very quickly moved right into sustainable agriculture because, you know, you needed a solar farm. You needed to think about those same principles on the farm, and that's the resource that people had to steward. And so that's really the organization that gathered like-minded people in the 80s in Montana who knew that they needed to work together to figure out how to do non-chemically based agriculture.
I want to talk a little bit about David Oyen and Timeless Seeds. It seemed like it was a long journey of discovery, of ups and downs, to get to the actual, you know, title of the book, Lentil Underground, to get to the lentils. Could you tell us a bit about how they established the lentil market?
Yeah, well, it certainly wasn't easy, and they started off growing cover crops, crops that you plow into the soil, you don't harvest, you don't sell, you plow them under as biological fertilizer. So the original idea of the business was, hey, we're going to sell these to other organic farmers, and they were working with legumes. Those are plants that fix nitrogen. They pull nitrogen out of the air, convert it to a plant in available form, working with bacteria, and exude it through their roots, so it acts as fertilizer, both for the crop and the following crop. So they were working with legumes just as cover crops, but they weren't making enough money. So then they got the idea, well, you know, you can have your nitrogen and eat it too. So a lentil does all this stuff for the soil, but you can also harvest a crop off the top of it and sell it as food. Originally, they sort of had some interest from Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's dropped them very quickly because people weren't making soup in the summer, but that was the spur to, hey, okay, we should develop our own branded food line, and we'll start developing our own retail relationships with natural food stores. Now they work with chefs, farm to school, farm to hospital.
What I thought was fascinating, going back to the sort of the community aspect, is that originally when they were doing the seeds, they were trying to market black medic, which is essentially a weed. and it was, you know, you kind of lay out, you know, at the beginning that farmers really like lean heavily on this idea of cleanliness on the farm, about having a weed-free field, and that's why the chemicals play so heavily into it. So this idea of putting a weed then into the field as something to actually grow seems like it could have been a challenge.
That was very, very radical in Conrad, Montana in the 80s, absolutely. And, you know, not the kind of thing that they would easily get a bank loan for. So they David Oyen tells this funny story about when they did start to do the lentils. He goes to the bank because they needed to move into a food grade plant, you know, $40,000, and says, we've got a customer, Trader Joe's was interested, and we're an organic lentil business. And the banker had two questions: what's organic and what's a lentil?
It seems like it's a story about being told you can't do something and then doing it anyway. So what made the people in the book continue despite setbacks and being told that what they wanted to do was impossible?
I think, you know, that's a really diverse group of people involved in this movement across the political spectrum. You've got, you know, radical hippies, you've got radical libertarians. And so I think a lot about what unified them. And I think it's because they think about the long term. And so they saw that in the long term, it was absolutely impossible to continue chemically supported agriculture. And not even that long of a long term, like maybe the farm would quit in their generation. Maybe for economic reasons first, but the type of economic reasons that are deeply connected to ecology. So they had to do it. They felt like this was such an imperative that the only question was how. The question wasn't whether. The question was how.
So there's one person in particular, Russ Salisbury, who's a very interesting character in the book. He was kind of an early adopter of avoiding bank loans and chemicals. And it sounds like his property was a very interesting place. Could you tell us a little bit about him?
Sure. Well, you know, it's interesting how you introduce his character, because the truth is, what people will often say, I've seen this bumper sticker even, you know, organic food, or as your grandparents called it, food. So the truth is that for a lot of these farmers, that was exactly the case. Their grandparents were organic farmers. Their parents became chemical farmers. And some people skipped that move. And Russell Salisbury was basically in that category. He never went chemical, and he never saw the reason to. He had this kind of skeptical Montana persona of like, you know, if I can't be independent, why would I do it? Why would I do anything that requires me to kind of put my future and the quality of my land in the hands of anybody else? Always really careful about taking on any debt. So he just started farming without chemicals as soon as he could get a piece of land. You know, this is a guy who's about 80 now. So, you know, we're talking mid-century, and his neighbors thought he was nuts, and he thought he was nuts too. And he was just okay with that. He just figured, well, nuts is the way to be. He had this beautiful property along the Missouri River. You know, I mean, it could absolutely, he could be getting paid for this as a conservation easement, but he just thought, you know, why would I put myself in the hands of a banker? And then he tells this funny story about how somebody told him to show up to a sustainable agriculture conference in 1984. And he said, and then there were these professors telling me that what I was doing was the cutting edge of a science called agroecology. And I thought I was just a chintzy old weed farmer. So it just depends on kind of what you're trying to maximize, basically. And Russ is a great example of a totally different paradigm that's sort of about net rather than gross in a way. And rather than trying to yield as much as you can, you know, thinking about, well, if I'm not using a lot of resources, maybe I don't have to get as much of a crop either.
It was interesting that the sort of the turn of events that they ended up turning to him because he hadn't gotten himself into debt, that he ended up being an early investor.
Right.
That was really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you'd never guess that this guy has extra resources, but his wife was also raised on a homestead. And I mean, they just practiced this incredible, what we used to call home economics in a way, that again, is just based on such different principles than the growth model.
So we've been talking about the history of this sort of the Lentil Underground movement. What does the future look like? What's the next generation? What can we expect?
Well, it's a heck of a lot easier to be an organic farmer in Montana now than it was when these folks got started. Timeless Natural Food is now a $1 million business. They work with about 20 family farmers across the state of Montana, and they distribute to over 200 retail stores and chefs and farm to school, hospital. So it's a much more viable, it's a viable market. Organics is a $35 billion industry, and the organic grain companies are actually concerned about supply. They're actually working really hard to get new farmers on the land and ensure that there will be enough organic grain to meet the demand for organics. So I think the future is really bright in terms of the organic sector. The next challenge is to really move mainstream agriculture towards these same principles. That's happening a little bit. Cover crops in particular are now getting traction on conventional farms in Montana. Conventional farmers are seeing the benefit of planting crops just to build the soil. And the land grant university there is offering workshops for conventional farmers as well as organic. But that, I think, is the challenge. And that's why I wanted to focus this book on the whole movement rather than just on a single business or a certification approach or a labeling approach, because that's always going to be somewhat niche. And the benefit is through those certifications and those kind of niche markets, you can demonstrate an alternative. But you got to keep that underground of knowledge production and sort of social organizing healthy in order to broaden the base.
We've been talking about organic food, but I know a lot of the conversation about food nowadays is about local. What does local mean for somebody who's farming in Montana?
Well, that's a great question. There are some local food movements in Montana around the, quote, urban centers in Montana, Bozeman, Missoula, and you see folks doing CSAs and grain CSAs with lentils in them. But I'm really wanting to push against this idea that the local food movement should be the center of gravity of our food activism, because I think local is a proxy for building relationships, but we need to build relationships at all scales. So we need to build them locally. We also need to build them regionally and globally. So just like we get fair trade coffee from farmers in Central America as a partnership with people who are in a region where they're stewarding a resource that's important, but they may not have the economic base to support that, that's happening domestically too. So I'm actually kind of encouraging this domestic fair trade movement that involves people from population centers like the coasts mainly, supporting the family farmers in the middle of the country who are trying to change these areas that are generally quite low income, but so key to, you know, better environmental stewardship of our landscape.
Liz, thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. That was Liz Carlisle talking about her book, The Lentil Underground, Renegade Farmers and the Future of Food in America. As you've undoubtedly heard, bees have been in the news a lot in the last few years due to widespread colony collapse. You'd expect to hear about them on the news or on your friend's Facebook feed, but there was an interesting conversation about bees recently in an unexpected place. Matt Reed of Bee Thinking here in Portland was on the ABC show Shark Tank this past week attempting to gain investors in his business. During the show, there was a lot of talk of gross profit, return on investment, rate of growth, etc. But slipped into the economic jargon was a conversation about the state of bees. We have Matt in the studio with us to talk about bee thinking and his experience on Shark Tank. Matt, welcome to The Food Show.
Thanks for having me.
So before we talk about Shark Tank, tell us a little bit about bee thinking.
Yeah, bee thinking was created in 2008 when a honeybee flew into our kitchen. I saved this bee, fed it some honey, it flew off, and then later on a bunch of honeybees were flying into our screen door. So really it was this bee found me and chose me to be its keeper. And that's when I became addicted to honeybees and started building hives and blogging about it. And then soon people all over the country were asking to buy my hives. And so that's how we created this business in our garage, and it grew from there to a little space in the Sellwood, and now we have a larger retail space just off of Hawthorne and 18th in Southeast Portland.
And at this point, I mean, the business is fairly substantial. You're selling hives all over the country?
Yeah, we ship worldwide, mostly to the United States, but a lot to Europe and Australia, and people want to create backyard farms, and that includes bees, chickens, goats. I call that the trifecta. And honeybees are becoming very popular, and partly that's, of course, due to the losses of honeybees that we've all heard about since 2006 and even before that. People want to do their part somehow to help honeybees, and so one way to do that is to keep a hive in your backyard.
And what sets apart your hives at Bee Thinking and the other products that you sell?
Yeah, so our hives are focused We're focused on providing hives for backyard beekeepers. So we're not really catering so much to the commercial beekeepers, people that do this for a living, but we're really targeting those folks who want one beautiful hive or two beautiful hives in their backyard, and not just backyards, but rooftops and balconies. We have lots of customers in big cities like New York who don't have a yard, but bees can fly. So their bees will fly and forage throughout the city. So our hives are made out of cedar, which is one area that we differentiate ourselves as we use premium materials. We also incorporate things like windows so that you can look inside your beehive. So it's like having your own ant farm almost on your balcony or backyard, which is really cool if you have friends or family over and you want to show them inside this amazing organism, because we like to view it as one organism made up of lots of little organisms.
So give us a little bit of a primer on the show you were on. What is Shark Tank?
So Shark Tank is a show where entrepreneurs, inventors, people like that go into what's called the tank, the Shark Tank, and they pitch their idea or their business to the sharks, who are, it's five millionaires and billionaires who are relatively famous. And you pitch your idea, you have 2 minutes to really make your statement as to why your business or invention is awesome and why they should give you money. And you ask for a certain amount of money, usually for equity in your business, and then they get to flay you on national television. So it's you really need to know your numbers. You need to know their typical questions that they're going to ask you, because if you falter in any of those areas, you're going to have a very bad time in there.
And this is national television. What's the process like of getting on that show?
It's a very long process. I emailed them back in October 2013, and they finally contacted us in April 2014 and said that they're interested. And so at that, from then on, it was really submitting videos and emails and phone calls with producers and lots of paperwork and lots of silence, because they leave you in silence, waiting and waiting, hoping that they'll get back to you again. And finally, after months of this, starting in April and ending in August, they finally confirmed that we were going to be filming and that they'd be flying me down to LA to Sony Pictures where they filmed the show. And so that was pretty amazing to know that we jumped through all the right hoops and we made it that far and I was going to be getting down there. But even if you get down there and film, you may not air because it may not have been good television. So there's always this fear, even after you film, that you know you made it as far as you can make it. There's 50,000 applicants for this show and they only air about 120 of the businesses. And so I was constantly in fear that we weren't actually going to air. And then they did contact us a few weeks ago and said we would be airing. So we were overjoyed.
So your segment, it did just air, and I watched it. And you seemed pretty cool when you were giving your pitch on the show. But I have to imagine it must have been extremely stressful. What were you feeling as you were standing in front of not only potential investors, but the cameras?
Yeah, my producers actually wondered if something was wrong with me because I was, I guess, very calm. I guess I just appear calm. I felt nervous as I walked in. I've watched the show for years. I think I'm on the sixth season, so there's been a number of seasons now. And so it's really surreal to be walking down that hallway. There's no music when you're there filming, so it's complete silence. It's cold, and then there are dozens and dozens of cameras and probably 100 people around you that you don't see on camera. And then you're walking down this hallway and you see these people you've watched on TV for years and you're talking to them. And it's really life-changing to be there and doing that. And after you finish your pitch, there's silence for a little while. And that was one of the scariest parts, is not knowing what's going to come, what they're going to ask, and being able to field all those questions.
Interesting, because when you're watching the show, you give your pitch and they just come right in and start asking you questions.
Yeah, once the questions start coming, they all come at once. So that was another thing you're not prepared for, because they really edit this down to 7 minutes, but I was probably in there for 30, 40 minutes. And so you only get to see part of what happened inside the tank. And they really make it seem like there's one question and one answer. But generally, there were five sharks asking me questions at a time, all staring at me, wondering if I'm going to answer their question and giving you funny looks when you don't.
Mm-hmm. And I want to get to the conversation about bees, but first, people generally like to keep the details about their relationship with money guarded. What was it like to lay your business finances bare on national television?
That was pretty hard. We've never told anyone things like that, but you have to when you're going on the show. So it's really just part of it. And at that point, I wasn't that scared. I'm not fearful other businesses are going to come in and take advantage of us because they know these numbers. I think it just shows that our business is doing well. And I think also we were portrayed well on the show. I think they made us look good, which is great.
Okay. So you talked earlier about sort of the inspiration of starting Bee Thinking, how it was kind of this idea of being stewards to honeybees. And I thought it was great how bee advocacy was snuck into the show. Was that partially your goal when you're going on the show, to talk about the bee situation, or was that just a pleasant surprise?
Yeah, I mean, that's an overarching part of our business, is the importance of honeybees and other pollinators. And we like to encourage people that if they can't keep a beehive, they could plant some flowers, they could avoid using pesticides, they could be better stewards of the environment. And hopefully they'll start a beehive at some point, because that's our business. But No, I was happy the way the show decided to focus on honeybees. We were the business that they did a home package where they flew into town and they filmed me in a beehive. And so they really wanted to make that part of the episode. And I wish it had been a little more because we filmed hours and hours of interviews talking about the importance of honeybees. And they, of course, had to edit it down to something 2 minutes or less. But I think it was great to see that kind of press on national television to an audience that may have otherwise not known anything about honeybees. And we know that a couple of the sharks, probably maybe even more than a couple of the sharks up there, didn't know that, you know, at least a third of their food is pollinated by bees of some sort, and they wouldn't have it without them. So I think it opened their eyes, and I'm sure it opened the eyes of millions of other people.
And what was surprising to me was that one of the sharks, I forget which one, like, had experience with honeybees, had raised them, or I forget exactly, but had a personal experience that also made it into the show.
Yeah, Kevin O'Leary, who always seems to know everything on the show. That seems to be his role, is knowing everything about everything. He had some experience with bees. I think he'd been around them. And I wish they'd shown some more of our banter, because I really got to show that he didn't know that much about honeybees. And the other sharks thought that was pretty hilarious.
So this is a spoiler. People can go back and see this segment. I'm pretty sure it's online. But at the end of the segment, you didn't receive none of the sharks invested in the business. So in that moment, how did you feel?
It was pretty depressing. I finally, when we went in, I did want a deal. I went in high because that's generally what you got to do because they're going to usually cut your valuation in half. So I went in, double what I thought, maybe a better valuation would be. I don't think I got to convey clearly enough that I was willing to negotiate. But a number of the sharks went out just because they thought we were fine without them. And so that's the best way you can fail to get a deal on the show is to walk out of there with them patting you on the back saying you're going to be fine and you're doing great. And I mean, right after that episode, Damon DeJohn, one of the sharks, he actually sent his assistant in to buy one of our hives. And so he's communicated about BeeThinking since, and most of the sharks tweeted about us the night it aired and said that BeeThinking is awesome and wished us good luck. So it's really good to have that kind of connection with them.
And then I imagine there's going to be some other after effects of the show. So you've already made one sale, but I imagine that more people will have seen the beehives, have realized that that's something that they can do, and will get in touch with you.
Yeah, we had thousands and thousands of people on our site the night that it aired, because we are mostly an online business while we do have our retail store here in Portland. And so it's been just probably thousands of emails and chats and phone calls that we've had since in just the last 4 days. And so when you have 7 million people see your stuff, you're bound to sell some of it. So we're selling a lot of beehives and other things. We have not just beehives, but of course, honey. What would a bee supplier be without honey? Wax and candles and all those hive byproducts and things for people to buy.
So I want you, this is an exercise. There's all these people who have just now recently gotten into or understand that keeping bees is a thing that they can do. What's your advice to those people?
To research. There's a lot to learn about honeybees. And so, even if you can't start this year, you have a lot of time to learn more about these creatures. They're incredibly complex. Read books. Come take a class if you're here in Portland. We've got classes usually every other week talking about the basics of honeybees and how to get started. There's a lot of videos online. There's a lot of content on our webpage, which is beethinking.com. So try and learn as much as you can about bees and figure out where you're going to put them and what kind of hive you're going to use. And maybe you're not ready for bees. So again, you could plant things. You could even get involved at Zenger Farm. They have a bee project going on out there. Portland Urban Beekeepers is an awesome group that I'm part of, and it has a lot of members. So there's a lot of people here in Portland who are into bees, and you can learn from them.
Great. And so tell me then, what is the future for bee thinking?
I think we're just going to continue what we're doing, making premium beehives and helping backyard beekeepers get started all over the world. And then continue offering other products that are tied into that, which of course we also sell mead in our store. Mead is honey wine, and there's a good symbiotic relationship there between this beverage, which is very old. We do tastings there every weekend, and in fact this coming weekend we have a tasting going on called the Gold Medal Mead Event, because we have a number of gold medal meaderies here in Portland and in Oregon who are going to be pouring for us. So it should be fun to have people coming in to taste some mead and talk about bees and beekeeping and Shark Tank and whatever else you want to talk to us about.
Great. And one more time, just if you could tell people how they can get in touch with you, your website and whatnot.
Yeah, our website is just beethinking.com. That's BEE and then the word thinking. And then our retail store is off of Hawthorne and 18th. It's 1551 Southeast Poplar Avenue. And we're open 7 days a week.
Great. Matt, thank you so much for joining me on The Food Show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Reed of Bee Thinking, who recently appeared on the television show Shark Tank. That's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests Marisha Auerbach, Congressman Blumenauer, Liz Carlisle, and Matt Reed for being on today's show. I also want to thank our incredible engineer, Kate. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives, and don't forget to tune in again the third Wednesday of May for another episode of The Food Show. Until then, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening. It ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away. Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, because you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people.
And I just want to add for you listeners, if you're looking for Mauritius contact info to find out more about what she's doing and where her classes are, her email address is sewingevolution@gmail.com. That's sewingevolution@gmail.com. And then her events are listed on the Portland Permaculture Meetup, so you can contact her that way. Thanks for listening to The Food Show and for listening to KBOO.
Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protects them.
And that concludes Wednesday Morning Radio Zine here on KBOO Portland. Stay tuned now for the noon headlines, followed, as always, on Wednesdays by Jazz Lives. So keep it right here on your community station.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for Wednesday, April 15, 2015. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson.
In local news, recognizing that the city's poorest residents have few options for living in good neighborhoods, housing officials in Portland are working on a plan to open 500 units in designated opportunity areas. The decision represents a significant policy shift in the Housing Choice Voucher Program, often called Section 8, and will eventually result in long-term solutions for thousands of low-income residents.
Shareholders at Alteria Corporation have sent letters to the company's management, urging them to the negotiating table with Intel to pursue a purchase deal after Altera turned down a takeover offer last week. The letters question Altera's ability to create enough value on its own. Intel reportedly bid about $54 a share for Altera.
In national news, a complaint is expected to be filed today by the European